From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, the future of land use in southern Arizona will be the focus of a meeting to be held next week, including citizens and lawmakers from across the region. Peter Michaels talks to Arlen Colton, a planning official in Pima County, about what issues are going to be foremost on the agenda. Claudine LaMonaco visits Patagonia, Arizona, to talk with acclaimed Western author J.P.S. Brown about his latest books and life on the border, including his previous careers as a cowboy, a boxer, and a whiskey smuggler. Hear the music of twin sisters Andrea and Juliet Wilhelmi, who comprise the band Mirror Image. And a new book published by the UA Press documents the poverty that exists along the border and looks at what life is like for those living in the impoverished settlements known as colonias. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. The Tucson Regional Town Hall in 2007 created a way for the residents and the policymakers of southern Arizona to discuss, and most importantly, to take action on the topics that are of the most concern in our area. The latest meeting is scheduled for next week at the Tucson Convention Center, and this time the focus is on land use. To define the issues that surround this complex topic, Peter Michaels talks to Arlen M. Colton, a planning official from Pima County.
The next community conversation takes place on December 3rd, that's next Wednesday, and the focus is on land use planning. What exactly is that, and what is the goal?
Well, I think the goal is going to come out of the meeting, but over the last year, a whole bunch of different organizations, the American Institute of Architects, the Daily Star, the Town Hall, the Urban Land Institute, and others have all held forums talking about land use, and at least in part of their conversation, and talking about regionalism. At the same time, the communities in the public sector have also been talking about it amongst themselves. And I think this is an opportunity to bring everybody together in one place and see if there's some commonality for collaboration on regional land use planning.
And the Regional Transportation Authority, it took years to get that passed. Is it realistic to think that this will happen any sooner, a regional plan for development?
We hope that building upon the success of the Regional Transportation Authority in its funding and planning process and regional collaboration will be good. But regional land use planning is a different animal. First of all, there's no money involved in terms of building infrastructure. There's no taxes to deal with. It's really more of a collaborative spirit, seeing where there's common ground on such things as principles of sustainability. How do we look at our landscape, our built landscape, from a regional perspective in terms of activity centers? That means commercial, but also other forms of employment. And in looking at how it all fits together, so it's really coming up with a high-level plan that each of the communities can implement as opposed to a funding mechanism that we would have to campaign for.
And I know you're looking down the road 10, 20 years out, but if you drive around the area today, you go up north of Ina up into Oro Valley, and you see a lot of growth going on, a lot of development of shopping centers and housing. And then if you come down Stone or First or Oracle, south of River, it seems right now like there's not a lot going on. Will you be addressing that?
Well, I think that what we're looking at is the big picture. Growth is occurring, certainly a little slower now as a result of the economic woes that we're all facing in this country. But growth is occurring throughout the valley, or has been occurring. Over the long haul, we recognize, I think everyone recognizes, that we're going to continue to grow. But the current performance right now is not necessarily what you'll see on down the road. We've done a pretty good job as a region, not perfect, but pretty good job in defining our open space and our boundaries and places where we don't want to grow. And one of the focus points of this conference is looking down the long term, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. What do we want the built environment to look like? What do we want it? How do we want it to function? How can we make it more efficient? How do we make it a place that people want to be and provides the needs, both the human needs and the economic needs and the environmental needs for current residents and residents and businesses who are yet to come here?
Well, that is the question. How do you provide that? If we are going to grow, but how do you make room for the development and also for the sensitive habitat areas?
We've done, I think, as I said, a pretty good job of with the Sonoran Desert Conservation Plan in the county, and several of the jurisdictions have either adopted the principles of that plan or are considering them. We've done a good job with that. Now, within our built environment, we still obviously will be wanting to make sure that people know they're in the Sonoran Desert when they're here. And so when we talk about the built environment, it doesn't necessarily mean blading everything to put up houses, shopping centers, and places of employment. It also means open space. It means parks within that area as well. But while each community does its own planning, does its own zoning, and that's important because each community is a very individualistic place. When we look at how all of this needs to be regionally connected, it seems, it just is logical that regionally we ought to look together, at least at a high level, and talk about how all of these land uses are interrelated. By doing so, we can account for the population that is here now and the population that will be here. We can also talk about how do and where we expand infrastructure, and how do we identify activity centers, placing them in locations that are close to where people live and will live, so that we reduce the impact on our transportation system. They call it transportation demand management, the technical term. But really what we're saying is, instead of necessarily having to build our way out of our woes, we may be able to manage our way through better collaborative land use planning.
Do you envision some sort of authority or commission that will accept proposals from the different communities, say the city of Tucson or Oro Valley or Marana, to develop those areas, but those proposals will need to be approved by an authority?
I don't think anybody's talking about another layer of government, certainly. Governmental reviews of land use have historically in Arizona and in Pima County been local decisions. But having a voluntary and collaborative process by which we can talk about, are there ways that we could all be doing a better job at making this a more sustainable region, sustainable environmentally, sustainable economically, and sustainable from an equity or social basis? That's the focus point. So it's not a new layer of government. It's not a new layer of review. The idea is to bring all of these people who've been talking about this together and see if there is interest and if there is a way to make that happen. But we're not talking about some regional authority that would have some extra level of zoning approval or something like that. That's not what this is all about.
Crafting Tomorrow, a community conversation on regional land use, will be held next Wednesday, December 3rd at the Tucson Convention Center from 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. The public is encouraged to participate. For more information, visit our website at kuaz.org. If you ask Joe Brown what he does for a living, he'll probably say he's a cowboy, but he's also known as one of the best authors to come out of the Southwest. Claudine LaMonaco travels to Patagonia, Arizona, to talk to J.P.S. Brown about his most recent books and his life on the border.
Every day, J.P.S. Brown fills up 4 buckets with horse feed, then loads them onto a wheelbarrow and travels out to a corral to feed his 4 horses. Brown, known to his friends as Joe, is too young to remember the first time he got on a horse. He's a 5th-generation Arizona cowboy and still rides, though most of his horses are too old for that.
They're creakiness and arthritis, and if I'm lucky, I have one of them that's sound enough to use. And then I just ride slow, and I don't get in any hurry.
Brown began writing in college at Notre Dame, where he studied journalism. He published his first book, Jim Cain, in 1970 to critical acclaim. It was later turned into the 1972 movie Pocket Money with Paul Newman and Lee Marvin. His books told of modern cowboy life in the West and along the border. Brown's been a Marine, a boxer, a whiskey smuggler, and a journalist. But mostly, he's earned his living as a cowboy, bringing in rodeo steer from the Sierra Madre mountain range just south of the border, and then later wrangling horses for movies.
I had these 4 horses on Rambo 3, You know, we did it in the Afghanistan segment of Rambo, and these horses made enough money during that movie to keep them the rest of their lives.
To read Brown's books is to enter a world that no longer exists, one where the cowboy was king and the border was not so much a barrier as a culture, a mingling of all things Mexican and Anglo. In October, he published a book based on his experience growing up along the border. It's called The World Through Pancho's Eyes.
None of us were Mexican, but we considered ourselves Sonorans.
He says that in those days, many of the ranch owners and workers were Mexican, and cowboys regularly traveled back and forth into Mexico. Brown learned Spanish before he learned English.
My mother didn't even try to make me talk English, but she did try to make my sister talk English, and my sister was so stubborn that she would not talk English.
Brown's family settled here generations ago, when southern Arizona was still Mexico, and only, he says, because of the generosity of Mexicans who sold his family land to get started. And he's sympathetic towards Mexicans who now cross the border looking for a better life.
The Mexicans had been here 150 years when my great-great-grandfather settled here, and now they're coming back. And they've always been there. And it's something primal in them to what they're doing now is migrating to better themselves.
In 2003, Brown won the Lawrence Clark Powell Lifetime Achievement Award. It's sponsored by the Pima County Library and Arizona Historical Society for contributions to Southwest Letters. Bruce Dingus runs the Historical Society's publication department. He said Brown was an obvious choice for the award.
Joe has produced three of the great novels of the Southwest, Jim Kane, The Outfit, and Forest of the Night, which I think if you were compiling a list of 10 great Southwestern novels, it would be up at the top with Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian as the two probably finest novels of the Southwest.
Dingus said Brown is a singular voice.
No one writes the kind of cross-border books that Joe does because he moves effortlessly between the two cultures, and he has a great sense of the cowboy life without ever romanticizing it, and his characters are just grounded in the everyday cowboy of the U.S.-Mexico borderlands.
Brown lived in Tucson for years, but lost his home when the movie industry in Arizona dried up. Today, he lives outside of Patagonia in a ranch house, tucked away in a hollow covered with sycamore, mesquite, and cottonwood trees. Wind chimes hang from his porch. Looking out, you can see the rugged mountain terrain he used to work as a cowboy. Brown writes fiction, but he says all his books are autobiographical. His latest book, Wolves at the Door, came out earlier this year. It picks up the story of Jim Kane, the title and main character of his first novel. He says it gave him a chance to visit with friends and characters from the earlier times in his life, like his partner of 40 years from his days working cattle in the Sierra Madre. The first night they met, they were supposed to talk cattle, but instead they got into a drunken brawl the next morning.
I was crippled, my knee was swollen, I had a back eye, and I went out there and he was in the corral with the cattle, and there wasn't a mark on him. I thought I sure had whipped him. And I was the one limping and with a black eye. And he just came up to me and shook my hand and said, "Hi, Joe." And we just looked at the cattle. From that day, we were like brothers. We were never apart.
The villain in Wolves at the Door is a drug cultivator and smuggler. Brown based him on a real man he knew for years. For Brown, drugs are the real problem along the border, not illegal immigrants. He's seen the Sierra Madre turn into one of the highest drug-producing regions in the world, and he's also seen the toll it's taken.
Now the drug cartels have a chokehold on Mexico because no man can stand up to them. No man in the government can stand up to them because they don't just go for the man. They go for his family, his children, his babies.
Brown thinks the U.S. needs to get Mexican workers out of the desert so Border Patrol can focus on the real bad guys. Bruce Dingus said that when the judges chose Brown for the Powell Award, they assumed he'd done most of his life's work. But at 77, Brown says he's got several more books in progress. He says there are just too many stories along the border to slow down. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Claudine LaMonaco.
We'll have more Arizona Spotlight right after this break. Welcome back to Arizona Spotlight. October 2008 would have marked the 68th birthday of John Lennon. His widow, Yoko Ono, has worked diligently to keep John's memory and his message alive for new generations. One example is the John Lennon Educational Tour Bus, which since 1998 has traveled across the country, providing free hands-on programs to hundreds of aspiring musicians, and it gives them access to a mobile, state-of-the-art recording studio. Two young musicians who had the opportunity to record and make a video on the Lennon bus are twin sisters Juliet and Andrea Wilhelmi, who perform as Mirror Image. They came to Tucson 3 years ago from the small town of Roundup, Montana, and they're juniors at St. Gregory College Preparatory School. Not only did they get a chance to record their song, it became the winner for best song in the jazz category of the John Lennon International Songwriting Contest. It was voted on by a panel of celebrity judges, including Bob Weir and Al Jarreau. I asked Andrea Wilhelmi to tell us about how the whole process started.
That started actually with the Tucson Battle of the Bands, because we just kind of, we sent in our three songs, you know, just kind of to see what would happen. We didn't expect to get anywhere with it, so we were amazed when we got into the top six. And then they announced, like, the third place and the second place, and these were, you know, rocker bands, guys with the spiky hair and the, so we felt like it had been some sort of cruel joke, you know, that we were in this. But then they announced the winners from St. Gregory. We just completely freaked out.
Because you knew then it must be you.
Uh-huh.
How did you end up being in the Battle of the Bands in the first place? Where does your musical collaboration start?
Well, we grew up in a really musical home. We grew up listening to our parents' old records of, like, the Beatles and James Taylor, and we played the piano, and I played the clarinet, and Andrew played the flute and the band and stuff. And then when we were 12, we got guitars for Christmas, and I don't know, we just kind of took off from there.
Did you find it natural to write music together and to play together?
Yeah, we just started writing. I mean, now we can't really write songs together. That's too big of a clash of artistic energy, I guess you could say. A lot of door slamming. And But we do collaborate on arranging songs. And
when you perform live, it's just two guitars?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How you do it?
So far. At this point, yeah.
Well, how did you get the full sound on the recording A Miserable Thing?
I don't know. Just the guys on the bus were so great, and they just mixed it really well. And, like, I don't know, it's really a state-of-the-art recording studio that they have in there.
So you win the Battle of the Bands, and therefore they put you in contact with the John Lennon people? Or how did that
situation? That was part of our first prize was to spend a day on the John Lennon tour bus recording a song and then a music video. And, you know, we were tired when we got there. It was early in the morning, and we'd been up late night before celebrating. And they told us that in order to record the music video, we were going to have to sing the song 30 times. And they weren't exaggerating. We sang the song 30 times.
Tell us about where you shot the video.
Well, we shot it in Club Congress.
Was that the first time you'd been in Club Congress?
Actually, yeah. And it was really great because we went back there and
The tap room,
yeah. And yeah. We found all these mirrors, and it was kind of perfect because, you know, we're called Mirror Image and everything, and so, yeah.
Yeah, Seamus on the bus who did the photography, he was really excited about all the shots that he got with the mirrors, and so that was really cool.
So tell me about the song, Miserable Thing, which is a great title. By the way.
Thank
How
you.
Did that come about? Who started writing the project?
I started writing it.
Okay, Andrea.
And Andrea, yes. I set out to write something with a little more of a jazz sound, and I don't know, because in this lyrics, kind of the character in the song, she's in love with somebody that she shouldn't be in love with, but at the same time, the music has a really playful kind of feel to it, so I ended up getting a neat irony with that.
Oh, it's a miserable thing, the way you're always prancing around my feet. How am I gonna get a jazz name if I can't even get up the street? Oh, it's a miserable thing.
Juliet, can you tell me about your contribution to Miserable Thing?
I don't know. I guess I kind of pestered Angie into working it up. I was like, oh, this is really good. And, well, I don't know. I wrote the high guitar and harmony parts for it.
Well, I had it longer. Like, I had an extra kind of half a verse tagged onto the end of it, but she persuaded me to take it out and ended up being glad I did because
we
it got
we
too
help
long.
Each other that way because yeah. it's yeah. really hard to take something out of your own masterpiece. It's easier to have somebody else do that, and that's kind of the advantage of having the two of us.
We also rewrote the melody a little bit.
People at home don't know this because they're not sitting across the table from you, but you're twins.
Yeah.
So I find your speaking voices to be different. Are your singing voices radically different?
I think they are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's just me. I mean, they blend, but at the same time, they're different. I guess. I don't know. We've always kind of had an ear for harmony.
And especially Andrea. I mean, she's the one who really will just improvise randomly when somebody's singing.
Andrea, what were you trying to say, essentially, with the song Miserable Thing?
I don't know. I kind of was writing through a different voice. It was just about, you know, being infatuated with somebody who you shouldn't love or who doesn't love you back, and the character in it is scolding herself for that. So I don't know, it's kind of a...
Something that I see in it is just kind of how people's personal tragedies aren't really as tragic as they seem sometimes, because it has that irony with the lyrics and the music kind of playing off each other.
The current economic downturn in our country is affecting almost every demographic, landing the poorest citizens in southern Arizona in a very difficult situation. Some of them have taken refuge by living in settlements called colonias, which are characterized by low-quality housing, lack of infrastructure, and high levels of poverty and unemployment. A new book documents the history of colonias. Next, Luis Carrion talks to one of the authors and to some of the individuals who are trying to break out of the cycle of poverty that dominates life in the colonias.
It might come as a surprise to many of us, but currently about 500,000 people live in officially designated colonias in southern Arizona and New Mexico, in some of the most economically deprived conditions in the U.S.
There's a lot of complex reasons for why we see the growth of the settlements, but there's economic reasons and there's policy reasons.
Now, a new book published by the U of A Press and authored by Adriana Esparza and Angela Donaldson seeks to shed some light on the situation in these impoverished border communities.
Our book is called Colonias in Arizona and New Mexico, Border Poverty and Community Development Solutions. We wanted to shed some light on what do we see happening in terms of Arizona and New Mexico. A lot of folks don't even know that we have these kind of settlements in Arizona, that we have poverty right outside our back door here in Tucson. And I think it was important for us to share what was happening and why these communities developed, how they've grown over time. And also, instead of just showing the problems, but what kind of solutions people have been able to develop and how government organizations like counties, federal government, nonprofits may be able to help residents in their quest to improve their communities.
85706 is the zip code that encompasses an area of Tucson that few people other than its residents are familiar with. Known as the Old Nogales Highway Colonia, it's an enclave of Pima County that is marked by poverty and limited infrastructure. The area is part of Pima County District 2, and for supervisor Ramon Valdez, the designation of Colonia reveals the unique problems faced by residents.
Several years ago, we designated the old Nogales Colonia as a model colonia. And the designation is a very simple one. It, at the time, was the only model colonia in the state of Arizona to receive special designation, not only from the state of Arizona, from Pima County, but from the federal government, in order to try and identify and try and resolve some of the real pressing needs that this community had.
The problems of this community, which now consists of around 1,600 households, are many, and the residents have to contend with unpaved streets, lack of public transportation, and unscrupulous landowners that subdivide their property without any regulations.
I mean, I think people want to have paved streets out here. They want to have better lighting. They want to have a bigger clinic if possible, maybe even a hospital if it could be possible, but that's in a long term. Maybe a grocery store. So there's a lot of things that this community wants and needs.
For the residents of the old Nogales Highway Colonia, change has been elusive, but now they are organizing at the grassroots level. Adolfo Araiza heads the Neighborhood Resource Center and is part of a group that is seeking to affect change in the area by first organizing their efforts as a community.
There's been a lot of growth, especially within the last 5 years. This area out here has grown like maybe, I would say, 75% more than when I moved here.
For residents like Elsa Cocoa, who has lived at South Country Club Road for more than 20 years, the changes in the community have long been overdue.
The road conditions and the water conditions, because everybody out here lives on wells. Some people own private wells, and they come and they say that the person cut off their water for no reason, and the gas. It takes a long time for the police to get out here. The ambulance, by the time you call the ambulance, and they find you're at your home because there's no street addresses, there's nothing to let people know where to go, well, the person might die.
These colonias are some of the country's largest pockets of poverty. And for Angela Donaldson, who works as a consultant on housing and community development for nonprofits, understanding the dynamics of these communities is only the first step in finding the solutions.
People have incredible self-help capabilities. They have done so much for themselves. They've managed to survive and build a home and a life for themselves without assistance, for the most part. And so I think any efforts to capitalize upon those skills and abilities are really important and just help people extend those capabilities that they have.
The future of the old Nogales Highway Colonia, like that of many communities, is dependent on the residents. The ability for them to affect change at the local level and at the political level will ultimately determine the future.
One of the things that I've asked to have happen is to begin empowering members of the community to start working together and to start identifying some of those things, both short and long term, that they and we can work together to resolve. So it's a very difficult process. It's a lengthy process. It's not going to be resolved today. Again, this is a problem that has existed for a very long time. It was created by the fact that this was a wildcat subdevelopment.
You know, working with Pima County and the way they're thinking is, let the people themselves get together first and let the people start changing themselves and how they think and how they do things. And so it's a slow process. We know it. We're gonna be doing some things. We're going to be changing this community. I really believe that. It's just going to take some time.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media. Arizona Spotlight is available to listen to online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.